From NPR and WBUR, I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and aerial spraying for Zika virus will likely start tomorrow in Miami-Dade County in Florida after the CDC issued a government warning for pregnant women and their partners to stay out of a popular neighborhood in Miami where local mosquitoes have caused 14 cases of Zika. Joining us now is Dr. Christine Curry, an obstetrician-gynecologist at the University of Miami Hospital. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And what are you advising your patients who live in or near this area in Miami and are pregnant or planning to become pregnant to do?
Sure. So for our patients who are already pregnant and who live in this area of concern, we are encouraging them to speak with their doctors as soon as possible so that we can discuss mosquito prevention and prevention of sexual transmission, but also so we can begin to arrange testing for them during the pregnancy.
And you say in this area of Miami, but what if they live in the neighborhood next door? I mean, mosquitoes aren't going to obey the boundaries of a neighborhood for very long.
This is true. No one showed the map to the mosquito.
Yeah.
So, you know, certainly we think that all of the areas have the potential for transmission. In this area of concern, we had weeks of investigation before we were able to really confirm that there was transmission. And so every place has the potential for infection and every place has the potential for the mosquitoes to have Zika. So even for women who don't live in this area, they're getting the same advice. Protect from mosquito bites, protect against sexual transmission, and be really thoughtful if they're pregnant about what their exposure to mosquitoes is.
And do they have to worry about what they use for protection against mosquito bites, that the DEET, that the pesticides even that are being used to spray in some of these areas could be harmful to humans as well?
Certainly, it's something that people are thinking about and people are talking about. All of the EPA-approved insect repellents in the U.S. are safe in pregnancy when they're used as directed. And so we're telling our pregnant patients to use the mosquito repellent that they get in their stores, whatever they have been using in the past that they're comfortable with. We want to encourage them to use it every time they leave the house.
How often do the people who get Zika actually have any symptoms or know that they have Zika virus?
So the majority of patients who have been infected with Zika virus are going to be asymptomatic or are just going to have mild symptoms. And so we can't really rely on symptoms to identify the people who have been infected.
So do you think there may be more than 14 cases in Miami at the moment?
I think what we've learned so far about the virus is that the patients who are actually sick are the minority of patients. And so I don't think from an epidemiologic perspective, it's unreasonable to think that there are more people who have been infected.
And therefore, should pregnant women, even if they have no symptoms, go into the doctor and ask or get tested for Zika?
Yeah. So women who live within this area in particular, we would like to test them in both the first and second trimester. If we find that it's more widespread than we thought or other neighborhoods have areas of infection, we would encourage first and second trimester screening in those pregnant women as well, even if they felt fine.
Do you expect this problem to get worse in Miami?
So it's a hard thing to try and predict, but now that we know we have local transmission, there's certainly potential for other areas to have transmission or for it to become widespread. And it is really important that when we're thinking about this, it's not just this neighborhood. All of us have the obligation to try and interrupt the chain of infection and deal with mosquito control in our own backyards.
That's Dr. Christine Curry, an obstetrician-gynecologist at the University of Miami Hospital. Doctor, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
So there's ground spraying in Miami's Wynwood neighborhood in hopes of killing mosquitoes that carry the Zika virus. Other communities are enlisting populations of bats that can eat up to 1,000 mosquitoes an hour. But as Laura Rice from Here and Now contributor Texas Standard explains, bats may not be the best weapon when it comes to getting rid of mosquitoes that cause Zika.
This is the sound of bats flying out of a cave by the millions. This is the sound of one bat squeaking to be fed by Diane Odegaard.
But she can chew and talk all at the same time. Okay, it's the middle of the day. You're not that hungry.
Odegaard is the Education and Public Outreach Manager at Bat Conservation International, based in Austin, Texas. But this isn't Odegaard doing her job. It's her at home being a bat lover, or more accurately, a bat rehabilitator.
That's always the goal of rehabilitation. It's not to gather as many animals as possible. It's to release as many animals back to the wild as possible.
Odegaard gets that not everyone understands her passion for bats.
Hey, Zoe. Hey, Susan.
But lately, more people are getting interested in attracting bats to their yards. That's because...
in the United States, the vast majority of bats are insectivorous bats.
That means they eat insects. And some researchers claim bats can eat as many as 1,000 mosquitoes per hour. That's welcome news in a world with mosquito-related viruses like West Nile, chikungunya, and now Zika.
Eastern red bats, which is a common foliage roosting bat around really all over the United States, they've found 27 separate insect species in droppings from the eastern red bat.
But did you catch that? Bats don't eat only mosquitoes. In fact, it appears mosquitoes are hardly their favorites.
When you think about it, mosquitoes are very small. They'd have to work really hard, in other words, to catch enough mosquitoes to get the protein that they need, where a moth, that's easier for them and more nutritious for them.
Another bat expert says that's not the only problem with this idea of bats battling Zika.
Primarily, the mosquito that carries Zika feeds during the day.
Fran Hutchins is the preserve director at Bracken Cave in San Antonio, Texas, the summer home to the largest colony of bats in the world. And bats, as we know, well, they come out as it gets dark. But what comes out during the day and might eat mosquitoes? I asked Tanya Homayoun with the Texas Office of the National Audubon Society.
There are actually several different types of birds that would eat mosquitoes.
Homayoun is a conservation biologist, and she says purple martins and swallows sometimes eat mosquitoes. Another mosquito eater is common in the South, Mid, and Eastern U.S.
Chimney swifts do seem to have, for studies that have been done on their stomach contents, it's not a lot, but they do take mosquitoes.
And just like you might put up a bat house to attract bats.
If you do not have a chimney or your chimney's capped, you can actually put up a chimney swift tower.
But here again, chimney swifts probably won't get rid of all of your mosquitoes. So while it certainly won't hurt to welcome both birds and bats to your yard, you probably shouldn't ignore the conventional wisdom, like dumping standing water and wearing long sleeves and pants. For Here and Now, I'm Laura Rice.
The U.S. battle against ISIS has expanded with a new campaign of airstrikes in the Libyan city of Sirte. The strikes were launched yesterday, and the Pentagon says the campaign could continue for a month. It's aimed at breaking the militant group's stronghold in this coastal region. Here's President Obama speaking today about the strikes and U.S. support for Libya's shaky new unity government.
It is in America's national security interests in our fight against ISIL to make sure that they're able to finish the job. And so we're working in partnership with them to assure that ISIL does not get a stronghold in Libya, even as Libya begins what is going to be a long process to establish a functioning government and security system there.
Life for civilians in Sirte under ISIS control, from what we know, is horrific. There are reported food and fuel shortages, as well as looting, violence, and home seizures. Phil Ewing is NPR's national security editor. He joins us from Washington. Phil, start by telling us what we know about yesterday's airstrikes.
Well, what the Pentagon says is that American warplanes, both human-piloted and remotely operated or drones, attacked a couple of key targets to help the fighters associated with this new interim government, including a tank controlled by ISIS and a couple of vehicles to enable them to make progress in their military campaign to get into the city and eject these ISIS fighters. And what the Pentagon says is as those troops on the ground need help, they will be responsive to requests for assistance for those types of airstrikes in the future.
Phil, ISIS's Libya foothold is the strongest outside of Iraq and Syria and the closest to Europe, but they've been expanding there for months. Why the increased U.S. air power role now?
Well, the U.S. has launched a couple of airstrikes against specific individual terrorists or groups of terrorists over the past several months, but this is the first time the Pentagon says there's been a group of fighters on the ground who are sympathetic to the West and the United States who have had the ability to get momentum going to try and make some gains, and in this case, in the city of Sirte. And so that's what has made the decision for the Defense Department and the President to begin these operations to support their work on the ground there.
We heard that there were plans back in March to bomb some 40 targets in Libya. Why was that plan abandoned?
Well, the Pentagon says that this depends entirely upon the conditions on the ground, and specifically the ability of the indigenous forces to make gains and then hold gains as they happen. And so they are letting the American officials in Washington are letting those leaders and those fighters in Libya drive the train here and do as much as they can do and not launch a big military campaign that those forces could not exploit. And so I think the U.S. has been hesitant about doing too much because they don't want to create so much space that they just worsen the chaotic situation in Libya, but pace the action appropriately so that those forces on the ground can make the most advantage out of it.
Phil, briefly, are those local forces up to the task? Libya has been in chaos.
That's a great question. It's a chaotic situation. There are several interim governments all kind of competing to control the situation there. And I don't think anyone knows the answer to that question, but this is the horse that Washington and the West, the European allies, have decided to back. And so they're going to go with it for as long as they can, I think.
NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
There are just over 3 months to go until Election Day, and we've been talking a lot about the presidential race, but there are many other people and issues on the ballot this fall, too, including the legalization of marijuana. At least 5 states will vote on legalizing it for recreational use, and 3 others will vote on making it legal for medical use. Ryan Nurz is chief cannabis correspondent for Fusion and author of Marijuana America, One Man's Quest to Understand America's Dysfunctional Love Affair with Weed. He joins us from Miami. Ryan, let's go through these states that are voting on legalizing marijuana, starting with the biggest state in the country by population, California.
Yeah, I mean, California, this is a pretty big watershed moment for California and maybe the world. I mean, it could become the biggest marijuana market on the planet. And, you know, people forget that California is really the state that started this whole, you know, legalization trend in the states in 1996 with medical marijuana. The only thing is they have tried this before. They had Prop 19 in 2010, and it was, you know, sponsored by big names like George Soros, and it actually lost. But that was a midterm election. I think in a presidential year, you get minorities, you get college students, and I think that'll push it over the edge.
We're also looking at Massachusetts and Maine and Arizona. What other states have this issue on the ballot?
Massachusetts is interesting. You know, they've had a very robust marijuana community for a long time, and there's never really been a northeastern state to have legal recreational weed. As you can see, if there's a map, it's all the Northwest right now, right? So that could be interesting. Maine is also vying for that spot as well. They've had medical marijuana for a while, a very sort of well-known and well-executed medical marijuana market. So I actually would expect that Maine will go. Massachusetts is a little more dicey.
And there are some other states that it's not yet on the ballot in, but could be by Election Day.
Yeah, that's right. So this is the time of year where people think, like, you know, you can discuss this as if it's really concrete. It's not. It's welcome to the world of weed legalization. It's very murky. So right now, for example, in Michigan has a huge medical marijuana community, but they have this battle going on. So they turned in 100,000 more signatures than they needed. The state has come back and said, you know, all of these signatures are way too old. So now they're being sued. And that's the type of thing that happens. It's not until about 2 months before that November 8th date that you really start to see which states are really on the ballot, are really a possibility. And that's when the attack ads start, which is already started here in Florida.
So behind all of these ballot measures for legalization of marijuana, is there one group, one national group that is pushing all of these and is advertising in favor of legalization of marijuana, or are these really at the state level?
They're almost all at the state level. And so the pro-marijuana campaigns at the state level then end up battling the sort of, you know, anti-marijuana campaigns. And I've found from my research that the pro-marijuana campaigns now are absolutely decimating the anti-marijuana campaigns across the board in almost every state, something like 3-1. However, in Florida, there is Drug-Free Florida, and it mounted a huge opposition to the proposed amendment in 2014, backed by like almost $6 million from Sheldon Adelson.
from Sheldon Adelson, who finances a lot of Republican campaigns year after year. What about the consequences of this? Let's say that the pro-marijuana side wins in a number of these states, including California. What are the concerns about that? Because we saw the former California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger calling this a flawed initiative that would bring about a host of legal nightmares and risks to public safety. We've certainly heard on this program about fears that if somebody's driving under the influence of marijuana, it's very difficult to figure out if they had just used it or if they had used it a while back, given the testing that's available right now. But what are people worried about if they do pass?
One is, like you just said, driving. You know, is it going to affect the, you know, driving accidents in that state? Child and teen use, is that going to skyrocket because of, you know, more access and more perceived sort of lack of harm around marijuana? And crime, right? I mean, is it going to, you know, there's the pro-marijuana groups say that crime is going to go down, that there's going to be less stress on these police forces, while the truth shows in places like Denver and Seattle that there's also a level of, like, you know, you have these dispensaries that have huge amounts of marijuana. They have cash because they can't always use banks, and so robberies become an issue. And the answer to all those questions is we don't really know yet. I mean, basically, everyone's waiting for Denver as this sort of sample territory. It's the sort of Amsterdam of America. And everyone's waiting for these statistics to really sort of feel finite, and they really haven't yet.
So do you think that if these measures pass, and especially if the largest state, California, legalizes recreational marijuana, that there's going to be a federal initiative soon?
I mean, that's the real big burning question around the sort of pro-marijuana legalization campfire, right, is when are the feds going to step up and see that there's a tipping point? You know, there's 25 states at this point with medical marijuana. There's 4 states plus Washington, D.C. with totally recreational legalization. And now there's been some talk that they are going to potentially reschedule cannabis from a Schedule 1 to a Schedule 2 and maybe even deschedule it, which is a little less likely. And I don't know. They've been throwing that around. The feds have sort of thrown that around and said that they were going to do it by June and then July, and then they've pushed it back. I think that that's something that probably President Obama and his staff is a little reluctant to do before he leaves office. But who knows? He might just, drop the mic on the way out and change it to a Schedule 2 drug, which would cause a restructuring of the laws against marijuana across the nation.
That's Ryan Nurz, who's chief cannabis correspondent for Fusion and author of Marijuana America, One Man's Quest to Understand America's Dysfunctional Love Affair with Weed. Ryan, we'll be watching as all these ballot initiatives go forward. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy. Have a good one.
Well, voters in Oregon legalized recreational marijuana in 2014, but you still can't legally buy it in more than 100 Oregon communities because some city and county governments were allowed to ban recreational marijuana businesses. But voters in nearly half of those communities will have the chance to overturn those bans this November. Chris Lehman from the Northwest News Network explains.
Sales are brisk here at Going Green, a medical marijuana dispensary in the small city of Albany, Oregon. You have to have an Oregon medical marijuana card to shop here. And owner Sean Amon says while business is good, a lot of people who walk in the door leave empty-handed.
We have 10 to 12 people a day come in to ask to purchase recreational, and we have to send them to either Corvallis, Salem, or Springfield.
As if on cue, a man walks in the door and asks to buy some marijuana, but he's from out of state and doesn't have the necessary paperwork. So he pulls out his phone and looks up directions to Corvallis. Amon says it's getting to the point where he doesn't even want to work at the front desk.
As a business owner, it feels incredibly frustrating to have to send customers down the street.
It's only about 12 miles to Corvallis, a mid-sized college town where a half dozen dispensaries will gladly sell pot to recreational users. But in Albany, only medical sales are allowed. That's because the city council banned recreational marijuana businesses last fall. People can still grow and use pot in their homes. The ban was put in place despite the fact that a majority of the city's voters approved the 2014 statewide ballot measure to legalize pot. though, truth be told, it was close. In a city of 50,000 people, the margin was fewer than 400 votes.
For a community our size, that's not very many people. So I knew our community was very divided on the issue.
That's Albany Mayor Sharon Canopa. She supports the council's ban on recreational marijuana sales. The ban is in effect until the November election, when voters will either extend it indefinitely or overturn it. Canopa says it was reasonable to take a one-year time out to let people in Albany see how recreational marijuana plays out in other Oregon cities. But she says, what's the big deal if Albany isn't a place where you can buy recreational pot?
Every community doesn't have to have every product that is sold. We don't have every business. We don't have an IKEA in Albany. You know, should we? Because they, you know, Portland has it. Should we have it?
Not everyone in City Hall thinks the ban is a good idea. Ray Kubczynski was one of two city councilors to vote against it.
We're driving business away and the tax revenue that's potentially available from it.
A tenth of the state sales tax on recreational marijuana is being divvied up among Oregon cities, but only to cities that allow recreational sales. The money has to be used for law enforcement. But Oregon also allows cities and counties to locally tax marijuana sales, up to 3%. And here's an interesting twist. At the same time that Albany's city council will ask voters if they want to continue to ban the sale of recreational marijuana, they'll also ask voters whether they want to tax it. To Going Green owner Sean Amon, it's another slap in the face.
Now that they feel like they could might lose the fight, oh, we want to make sure we get our 3%. Can we get our money? We need our money. And the audacity of that is almost comical.
But for Amon and Albany's other medical dispensary owners, the bigger question this fall is whether the city's voters will vote for the second time in 2 years to legalize the sale of recreational marijuana. For Here and Now, I'm Chris Lehman reporting from Albany, Oregon.
New research shows one of the last known groups of woolly mammoths, the Ice Age beasts, died of thirst. The study is published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and joining us now is the lead author, Penn State Professor of Geosciences, Russell Graham. Professor Graham, first tell us more about what you found.
We found that mammoths went extinct on an island about 5,700 years ago. This is an island in the Bering Sea. It's about 400 miles north of the Aleutian Islands and about 300 miles west of the Alaskan coast, so it's out in the middle of nowhere. The island was originally attached to the mainland on the Bering Land Bridge, which was the area that animals and people and plants could cross between Siberia and Alaska. And then with the melting of the glaciers, the sea level rose, and the island became isolated. And on that island, a group of mammoths were also isolated. And they persisted there until about 5,700 years ago and then went extinct.
And if we're talking about 5,700 years ago, I assume we are not talking about man-made climate change causing this to happen.
No, it's a climate event that happened naturally, and it was a climate that became warmer and more arid for the island. And it was a unique situation that as the glaciers melted, the island formed and it became smaller and smaller as the sea level kept rising. And this reduced the number of watering holes, that is, lakes that were available to the mammoths. There are no springs or creeks or rivers on the island. It's very small. And with the drying of the climate, the mammoths congregated around the water holes, and the water evaporated. And mammoths, probably like modern elephants, require large amounts of water, 70 to 200 liters of water per day. And so they really are dependent upon the water. And with the depletion of the fresh water, they became extinct.
Why did you decide to study this? What does this tell us about what we need to know today?
Well, I'm a paleoecologist, and I'm interested in how communities have reorganized themselves, mainly mammals, in the past because of climate change. The other important aspect is that part of this was caused by the sea level rise itself. in that it saltwater wedge penetrated the groundwater system of the island, and freshwater is lighter, so it floats on the saltwater. So as the sea level rose, it pushed the freshwater up, effectively making it less and less in the water table. And we're seeing the same thing happen today on South Pacific islands as sea level comes up. And in some cases, people are probably going to have to leave those islands because they're not going to have enough freshwater to persist there. This also may apply to Florida because the same thing's happening there. We have a saltwater wedge. And so sea level is coming up, and as it does, it's again reducing the amount of fresh water in the water table. And so everybody thinks about Florida and looking out and waiting for the sea to inundate them or, you know, flow over the state. But in reality, they may be affected by this limitation of fresh water before that even happens. So it's really a critical factor to understand, and I think this reinforces that we need to really take a look at that.
That's Penn State Professor Russell Graham, who's the lead researcher on this new woolly mammoth study. We'll link you to it at hereandnow.org. Professor, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Dilapidated farms, double wides, swimming holes, overgrown, yet still beautiful fields. People caught in the backwaters of rural Vermont populate the terrific debut collection of short fiction by writer Robin MacArthur. Her new book is Half Wild, and Robin MacArthur joins me now. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with a little reading from the story, The Women Where I'm From. Hannah has just returned home from Seattle to New England at her mom's request. Her mom has a health crisis. Mom and daughter are on the porch finishing up dinner.
The porch, like the rest of the house, is a mess. Newspapers and books and cast-off sweaters coating every surface. She sits in a vinyl-covered glider. I sit in the lemon-colored 200-year-old rocker she nursed me in until I was five. My mother puts her bowl down and picks up a pack of American Spirits. Mind? Of course. Too bad, she says, winking. My evening ritual. She lights a cigarette, closes her eyes, leans back into her chair, and starts talking. She says she's been ripped off twice this year. 2 months ago, she tells me, a young man wandered up the driveway looking for a place to stay, so she gave him a sleeping bag and offered him the hayloft. In the morning, she discovered the sleeping bag and the cash from her wallet were gone.
Robin, many characters in this collection love the land, the place where they live, their homes. But they also feel a little trapped by home. Family ties are tested by these conflicting desires to stay or leave. Talk about that a little.
Yeah, well, so I live on the piece of land that my grandparents settled in the 1940s in Vermont. And I grew up deep in the woods in a house that my parents had built themselves. And all of my neighbors were extended family. I had aunts and uncles and cousins. And so really this book is in some ways my own processing of that love-hate relationship with this place where I grew up, where I have deep ties. And I left, you know, I went to college, I then lived in Philadelphia and New York City and traveled a fair amount, but was always tethered, like a lot of the characters in these stories. It was a place that I couldn't ever fully leave and always wanted to return to, and yet returning is complicated.
Mm. And each of your stories stab holes in that bucolic fall foliage and maple sugar cliche of New England. I mean, you write about people who are eking out a living any way they can, people who drink and smoke too much, people who are weighted down by secrets and those conflicting desires to stay or to
mm-hmm.
go.
Yeah, you know, another thing that compelled me to write these stories, I went to Brown. So I left this kind of deep woods Vermont upbringing and I went to Brown University. And everybody I met said, I love Vermont. I have a ski home there, or I love summering there, or I love Ben and Jerry's. And I realized that, you know, Vermont has such an iconic place in our cultural story as this bucolic Vermont life, picturesque landscape, and yet it's a much more complex place. There's a lot of poverty, and because there are so many tourists and second home residents, there's an inherent clash, an ever-present clash between the haves and the have-nots, and newcomers and people who have been around for generations.
You've written on your blog about the life of a writer, which sounds at times a little like some of your characters. I mean, living hand-to-mouth, working several jobs. It seems like the kind of existence that wears on you.
Yeah, well, my husband and I are very lucky right now. We are making it work. We are musicians, and now that I have books coming out, I'm making a little money doing this. But I have cleaned houses. I've worked on my mom's farm. My husband has built houses, and we've just worked all sorts of odd jobs over the years, which is really what most people who live in Vermont end up doing. It's a place where you choose your location over your career for the most part. And so you find a place that you want to live, and then you figure out a way to make a living.
In the story God's Country, you look at racism through an older woman who slowly realizes her grandson may be part of a white supremacist group. Let's hear part of that story.
Mm-hmm. Her husband, Fred, was a racist. She knows that now, only it was the Vietnamese who killed his son and the Italians who worked in the quarries he didn't like. There weren't any black people here then, at least that she knew of. Now when Cora goes to Nelson for her grocery shopping, she is surprised how many different colored people she sees, Chinese and blacks and Mexicans, or people she thinks are Chinese and Mexican, though maybe they're from somewhere else. Whatever the case, they're all there in Nelson, the little mill town by the river, living in the houses where the mill workers used to live, tossing groceries into their carts, the kids begging for this or that, just like any kids.
How much of that story reflects your own growing up and experience from your own family there in Vermont?
The story, I wrote it because this was a real incident that sadly happened in the town that borders my town. There were a bunch of billboards or pieces of plywood put up along back roads with racist comments on them. I don't know the details of who put those signs up. I do know that when I was in high school, there were always a few pickup trucks with Confederate flags in the back window. So this was my way of just addressing Vermont's covert and overt racism, which has been here for a long time, like, and simmers as it does in many rural places. Again, this is me unpacking the vision that we have of Vermont as this lily white kind of idealist state, which has wonderful ideals as a state, but it is too white. It does allow this festering racism to grow and appear in ugly ways.
The people who leave Vermont in your stories always seem to have trouble staying away, as we've talked about. In The Women Where I'm From, Hannah's mother asks at one point if she's, you know, really glad to be home. Can you read her response?
Right. So her mother says, "Are you really glad to be here? You know, I thought you might hate it here." And Hannah says, "How could I? I look across the fields at the barns and the gardens and the ochre shadows of the trees. At the bottom of the hill, I can see the roof of Christie's Double Wide, the tin roof glaring white with sun. Inside, her mom, I know, is drinking coffee and watching reruns of Twin Peaks. I don't hate it here. I hate what happens to me when I am here. I hate the way it draws me in, the way it leads to nowhere but itself, the way everyone and everything is connected and a person cannot be free. It's too beautiful to hate it here," I say.
Robin, explain that feeling a little bit. Everything is connected and a person cannot be free. You're raising two children in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what message you have for them.
Yeah. You know, I think it's one of the main reasons I am raising them there. You know, I grew up in a house that was off-grid. Our electricity came from the sun. My parents grew most of our food. Our wood heat came from the trees in our backyard. So there's this interconnection with the natural world that I really want my children to grow up knowing deep in their bones, and also to know a community. You know, my dad used to drive me around back roads as a kid, and like many of the characters in this book, he would point out what land used to belong to who and why they sold it. And I think when we move to new places where we don't have that historical context, we lose out on a lot of the story of how people are displaced and how history reverberates. And so I definitely want to live with that, and I want my children to know that. It's also a little crazy. One has to be bold to move back to your hometown and then to write a book about your hometown while also living in that hometown. I might be truly crazy.
Strange looks at the local store.
Strange looks, yes. And I think I'll be doing a lot of defending of my parents for the next few years, letting everybody know which characters are not my parents in this book.
You're not only a writer, you and your husband have a band. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so for the past 10 years, we have had a band called Red Heart the Ticker, and we are just releasing our fourth album, and the songs have these themes that run back and forth between them. There's some catamounts and mountain lions in the album, and one of the choruses of one of the songs is Greetings from Fierce New England, which I think is a pretty good description of the New England that I'm painting a picture of in the book as well.
Robin MacArthur's debut collection of fiction is Half Wild. It's out today. Robin, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Are you still lonesome? Are you still handsome? Are you still breathing and greetings from fierce New England?
You're listening to Letter from Mount Philo from Red Heart the Ticker's new album, Tigers of the New England Forest. This is Here and Now. Amazon and Facebook hit a high note yesterday. Both companies pushed past ExxonMobil to become the fourth and fifth largest U.S. companies. That makes the top five all tech, with Apple, Alphabet, and Microsoft leading the pack. The industry giants are on a particularly good run, with Amazon, Google, and Facebook announcing soaring profits and growth. Here to talk about this is our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Jason Del Rey is senior editor at Recode. He joins us now from New York. Hey, Jason, welcome back.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
So you can see this as a rise in tech. On the other hand, it's also indicative of the huge slide in oil we've seen in the last couple of years. How significant is it in the industry to have Amazon and Facebook surging like this?
I mean, I think it's pretty significant, and I think there are a whole bunch of questions to ask. It's fair to question whether it's a good thing for the economy to have all this power consolidated in this one industry. On the other hand, would you rather have Exxon and a bunch of companies like Exxon at the top there? I don't know the answer to that, but for sure, this is something that a lot of people are talking about right now.
And it raises the old, is this a bubble question? Is this sustainable over the long term?
For sure. I think what we're seeing with Facebook and Google still is their dominance in advertising, and as mobile phone penetration continues to get more profound worldwide, they are still primed for huge growth there, since they combined own about, you know, almost 50% of the digital ad ecosystem. Mm. So this is just the beginning for them. And Amazon's playing in a lot of different fields besides e-commerce, including their cloud business, their where they store data and provide computing power for a bunch of companies and even government agencies. And that's a big piece of their profits right now.
Yeah, Jason, let's talk a little more about Amazon. I mean, the company was long seen as this cash burner. Oh, they're not making a profit. Last week, you know, it announced record profits for the third straight quarter, and CEO Jeff Bezos just passed Warren Buffett to become the third richest person in the world. What do you think's fundamentally changed for Amazon?
Well, I think part of it is just the scale they're at right now. You know, everything from, you know, sort of pricing advantages they now have when buying inventory, to sort of just, you know, fixed costs now are a smaller part of, you know, revenue as they gain scale. But a big piece of their profits right now is their AWS cloud computing business. It's only about 10% of revenue, but some huge number of their operating income. And so they're reinvesting a lot of that money back into that business, which is their fastest growing also. But it's also a nice buffer to reinvest into new projects like the Amazon Echo speaker, and as well as their core retail business, where they are just dominant in North America right now.
Let's move to Facebook. I mean, it also posted some strong profits. Is this all about ads as well? Tell us how Facebook is doing and why.
So it is. I mean, I want to say something like 80-something percent of their ad revenue is now from mobile phones. And a large piece of this is it's almost all app install ads, so an ad that drives you to download an app. And there's been some noise recently that people are today, you know, downloading fewer apps from the App Store. But there's reason to believe that's actually good for Facebook because advertisers now need new ways to put these apps in front of people to get them onto their phones. And so that's the story today. In the future, Facebook's making a big bet on video now, trying to get everyday people, you know, to stream live video. And the goal there is to get TV advertising dollars to move onto Facebook, which up until this point hasn't. The question is, can everyday people make video content that you and I and millions of people around the globe actually want to watch? And I'm pretty skeptical about that right now.
Yeah, interesting. And Facebook's put a lot into its Messenger app, similar to Snapchat, which is growing fast. Is there an indication that Snapchat is cutting into Facebook's growth at all?
I mean, Facebook would love to own Snapchat, right. And Mark Zuckerberg has tried and been denied. And so, yes, even today, Instagram, which Facebook owns, just came out with a product that's very similar to one of Snapchat's most popular products, called Snapchat Stories. And so, that is a concern. You couldn't tell right now in Facebook's numbers, but I think, you know, looking 5 years out, there is a big concern inside of Facebook at what Snapchat's rise means for it.
Finally, let's take a look back at Google, their parent company, Alphabet. There's been some concern expressed in the past by analysts that they're relying too much on ads. Has their revenue stream diversified, or is it still ads, ads, ads? Briefly.
It still is largely an ads business. They've done better in mobile than many people have anticipated, but their cloud business, enterprise business, they call it, like AWS at Amazon, is where they're looking for a lot of future growth, and that division seems to have grown much faster than expected in the last quarter. So that's a good sign.
All right, Jason Del Rey, he's a senior editor at Recode. Jason, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.